At the National Journalism Center in Washington, D.C., aspiring young journalists are taught not only the technical skills of their trade, but also a deep awareness of the issues they will be covering. This emphasis on in-depth reporting of the key issues facing our society originates with its founder and director, M. Stanton Evans. Throughout his distinguished career as a journalist and author, Stan Evans has worked to heighten the understanding of how economics critically affects political and social issues, and how an understanding of economic principles can greatly enhance the coverage of those issues. Whether reporting the news, penning an op-ed piece, or writing one of his numerous books, Stan has maintained this emphasis on the underlying principles that govern our society. M. Stanton Evans was born in Kingsville, Texas in 1934, but spent most of his early years in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Washington, D.C. His father, a Ph.D. in English literature and a mathematician, was a conservative thinker in his own right and an early influence on Stan.
I think his experience in government conservatized him, particularly working for the Atomic Energy Commission, and he got interested in the internal security aspects of the atomic project.
In 1951, Stan attended Yale University and then went on to do graduate work in economics under the highly influential Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises. Soon thereafter, he began working for the Freeman magazine, edited by the author and journalist Frank Chodorov, who taught the young journalist a thing or two about identifying and arranging the important aspects of a story.
I'll never forget the first time I handed in one of my elaborate manuscripts to him. It came back with just these big X's through all of, like, the first three pages. And he basically said, "Your lead is on page 4. And I started learning real fast from him what it was to be a professional journalist as opposed to a student writing an academic paper. And he was a very, very principled, free market libertarian.
In 1960, Evans' career took him to Indianapolis, where he was chosen to run the editorial page of the Indianapolis News, making him the nation's youngest editor of a major metropolitan daily, and putting him in close contact with another strong publishing figure.
He was Eugene C. Pulliam, who was one of the last of the old-time press moguls in the mold of Hearst and Pulitzer and Colonel McCormick. He was a very strong, entrepreneurial-type person, very strong opinions. He cared deeply about the stands that his papers took on issues. He wasn't one of these corporate types that, you know, let's see what the polls show and we make the paper correspond to that. He had certain ideas, and these papers expressed those ideas.
Critics of federal urban renewal.
In the 1970s, Evans began to more boldly express his own ideas, working as a syndicated columnist and as a commentator for CBS television and radio, as well as Voice of America and Radio America. His work reflected an uncommon respect for traditional values, along with a strong belief in individual liberty. He has published 7 influential books, including The Politics of Surrender, Clear and Present Dangers, and The Theme is Freedom. A consistent theme in Evans' writing has been his willingness to take a new view of widely accepted political theories and ideas and critically analyze issues based on their impact upon traditional values and liberty within a free society.
Not only do freedom and tradition, can they go together, they have to go together. And that if you don't have this underpinning of axioms about the value of the human person and the need to limit power, if you don't have those axioms, then you can't have freedom. And so if you try to build a free society on purely relativist, materialist premises, which is the nature of the liberal enterprise, that's almost exactly what it is in so many words, it's not going to work. It doesn't work.
Stan Evans has received honorary Doctor of Law degrees from Grove City College and Francisco Marroquin University. Stan Evans continues to write about the issues that affect liberty and continues to serve as director of the National Journalism Center in Washington, D.C., where he plays an active role in training young journalists to carefully analyze the issues they are covering. More than 1,300 young journalists have trained at the center since its beginning. They've gone on to jobs at all the major network and cable news channels and to major newspapers and magazines across the country. There they carry on Stan Evans' belief in responsible, in-depth reporting. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Stan Evans.
Stan, it's good to have you back here in Indianapolis again. Have a chance to talk about your life and views, and I thought maybe we should start with a little reminiscing about the old days,
okay.
Move on to Yale, and
right.
Your early career before you came here as a professional.
I went to Yale in the fall of 51, which was the fall that God and Man at Yale, Bill Buckley's book, came out and caused a great furor. And I graduated in 55 and went to work in the summer of 55 for the Freeman magazine, edited by a man named Frank Chodorov, who was a very famous libertarian author and journalist and a very fine man. And that's where I met our mutual friend Don Lipset. And I know later on you want to talk about Don, and he certainly should be talked about. I worked for that magazine until November, only a few months. And then in the fall of 55, Bill Buckley founded National Review and offered me a job with National Review, which I accepted. And I worked there, and I won't go down that road because it's kind of a digression, but I worked for Bill for not quite a year. And then in the summer of 56, I went to work for Human Events, which is a conservative newspaper in Washington, D.C., and worked there for 3 years. And coming back to our mutual friend Don Lipset, he was then here in Indianapolis. We had both been in New York. He came back here to Indianapolis. And he was very friendly with people at the newspapers. Jameson Campaign Sr. was then the editor of the Indianapolis Star. And they were looking around for writers. And he got me in contact with Jameson Campaign Sr. And I came out here to Indianapolis for an interview with the papers and got hired in May of 1959 to go to work for the Indianapolis News, which was then the sister paper of the Star.
Say a few words about Frank Chodorov, because he was is a Liberty Fund author and
marvelous,
a wonderful essayist.
Marvelous
in his own
man,
right.
Marvelous man. He was so generous to me. But the main thing about him was he was a great editor, and I was just fresh out of college, and like most, I thought I was pretty good, you know, writer. And I was writing, I'll never forget. The first time I handed in one of my elaborate manuscripts to him, it came back with just these big X's through all of, like, the first three pages. And he basically said, your lead is on page four. And I started learning real fast from him what it was to be a professional journalist as opposed to a student writing an academic paper. And he was a very, very principled, free market libertarian.
Say a little bit, at least, about Indianapolis before we go on to more.
Yeah, I'd gotten my
theoretical
I got
sorts
here.
Of things. Right.
I got here,
yeah.
And then I regressed. I
right.
went back. Well, I came out here as a young editorial writer on the Indianapolis News, and I was 24, and I left here when I was 40, 41. So pretty formative chunk of my life. I just had a lot of friends here, and enjoyed working on the paper.
Say something about the influence of the paper and some of the people you met working there. And that's the whole story of Pulliam and the Indianapolis Star News is
well, I mean, the,
remarkable.
The person is Mr. Pulliam, was Mr. Pulliam. He was Eugene C. Pulliam, who was my boss, the publisher of those papers, was, I guess, one of the last of the old-time press, you know, moguls in the mold of Hearst and Pulitzer and Colonel McCormick. And he was a very strong, entrepreneurial-type person, very strong opinions. He cared deeply about the stands that his papers took on issues. He wasn't one of these corporate types that, you know, let's see what the polls show and we make the paper correspond to that. He had certain ideas, and these papers expressed those ideas. And then the papers themselves, this is the state capital. It's the biggest city in the state, two newspapers in this city. So he had enormous influence on what happened in the state of Indiana. And it was an education to be part of that activity and gratifying because I was able to write things that I believed in. He would never require or ask even an editorial to write something that he or she did not believe. I mean, that's the way he was. And so I was able to write what I believed to be true and important. And on occasion, not often, but sometimes what you would write would have some impact on what happened. Like tax, we were always fighting against tax increases in the state legislature. Always, that issue never went away. So we were staunch against that. And we were able, I think, to have some impact on that or on questions of what to do in the schools and so on. And certainly that kind of influence is not possible when one is sitting, you know, like a fly on a wagon wheel in Washington, D.C., where you're just one of a zillion different small voices in a great big environment. Here, the papers were a large influence on a much more compact environment.
Did you have something in almost every day?
People who have not done that kind of thing think that sounds awful. But actually, it's not that hard. And the deadline, any journalist knows the deadline is your friend because there's no ifs, ands, or buts about
it. It's
got
to be there.
You're going to get it done. And when you think about it, you have 8 hours to write one editorial. I mean, the writing is often the least of it. It's getting the information, you know.
But already you were doing a lot more than just writing one editorial. You were out meeting people in the community, I know, conspiring with Jameson campaign and various things.
Others. But that was part of it. I didn't want to just sit. I mean, I'm not a shoe leather reporter or something. But I definitely wanted to learn about the community I was living in and be able to comment intelligently on what was happening here. And one of my beliefs is, and it was certainly Mr. Pulliam's belief, that the first duty of a newspaper is to cover your own backyard. It's very easy to sit and write an editorial about something that's happening, you know, what is happening in Bosnia, you know, and a lot of people do that kind of thing, but it has no impact, and you're not really changing anything. You write about your own, and I try to teach this to my students, you write about the community you're living in, you know much more about it, and you're able to have more impact on it, and also you're more accountable. I could say anything about Bosnia, and no Bosnian is going to show up on my doorstep the next morning saying, that was wrong. But I wrote about the school board in Indianapolis and got something wrong. There'd be somebody on my doorstep the next morning.
Could you say just a few special words about Don Lipset? You must have been his best friend, really, over the years.
We were roommates and friends, and he was best man at my wedding and vice versa. He was, as we have both observed, someone who was totally dedicated just to organizing things and getting people together and promoting the conservative / libertarian cause by networking and putting on events. And that's what he did all the time. And we spent many an hour operating from Indianapolis, sort of as guerrillas on the campuses. And what we did, we had there was no money, no budget, no nothing.
There never is any money.
Yeah, and he was in contact with these students, say, at Ohio State or Denison or anywhere, IU or Purdue or, you know, Michigan State. And they would say, we need a speaker. And we need to get a conservative speaker on this campus. So he would sign me up as the speaker. And then he would come by this great big old car that I don't remember what it was, and at the end of the workday, and pick me up, you know, the paper, front door of the paper, 5 p.m., hop in the car, and we'd take off, and we'd drive to Columbus, Ohio, and Ohio State by 7:30 or something. I would give a talk. After the talk was over, the more conservative kids would come up. He would sign them up, you know, to be members of ISI. And then we'd drive back. And we did that a lot. And I can't even remember how many times. But that's what he did.
But you've been doing that for a long time. You still make those kinds of
I
trips
do some,
to college
not,
campuses.
Not nearly as
well,
much.
Well, maybe not as much as you did, but you must have at least 40 years of these sorts of things.
Yeah, I do.
What keeps you going? What do you find there? What are your reflections about that over the years? Are things different? Are they better? Are they worse? Have students changed? What's your assessment of the American Academy now and then?
I think the answer to all of the above is I'm not sure. But so many conflicting things. I think that in many ways, many obvious ways, the campuses are much, much worse. Just in general. I mean, the political correctness and the speech codes and confiscating newspapers and people being brought up on charges for, you know, saying something that somebody else didn't like. That's all infinitely worse than anything that we had going back in the past. In other ways, there are more encouraging signs in that there are now, earlier I was talking about, I'd never seen any, you know, conservative literature in my life, really, until I ran into the Freeman magazine and ISI and Fee. Well, there's a lot of that now. That certainly is not the case. There's all kinds of material that college students get, can get, do get. There's a lot of activity on the campuses, conservative newspapers, some pretty good ones, and a lot of organizing of lectures and seminars and so forth by ISI and other people. So you've got these countervailing things going on where the campuses generally are much worse, but you have a lot more organized, you know, activity on the other side also. So how that balances out, I'm not sure.
You started writing about this phenomenon in your first book, 1961, Revolt on the Campus.
Yes.
Let me read you a quotation from Revolt on the Campus. See what you think about it looking back in those years. The ultimate resource of the conservative movement, then, is characterological. Requires men of strong convictions to wage this sort of patient struggle, the very sort of men who can attract and persuade the generation which follows. In proportion as conservatism can produce such leaders, and as they are annealed in the fires of combat, will the movement achieve its objectives. On the present showing, it has been remarkably successful. With continued effort, it can become more so. Do you think that promise has been carried out? And a related question, which you also go into elsewhere in the book, particularly quoting Shatterov, where he says it's got to be a movement of ideas. It's got to be, it can't just be political activism.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
got to be people who understand under the philosophical underpinnings. Have those two promises of the 60s been carried out, that you'll have strong men of convictions who understand in a principled way what they're about?
To some extent.
Who will become the leaders of the future?
To some extent. There have been many that have fallen by the way, and many that, you know, got there and then did something else. But I think, yes, I think in general, yes. And and this mixes into some other things that we had talked about before and you might want to come back to. But the whole, the Reagan phenomenon, Reagan was such a man. I mean, he wasn't part of that, but he was the kind of person that I was talking about. He had these strong convictions that were unshakable, and I think those were the convictions that ultimately won the Cold War, and which is another story. And there
we'll
are other
about the Cold War here.
Yeah, there are, and there are other people that I would cite, but Reagan is the obvious one that everybody knows about. So yeah.
Well, the early one is the Goldwater.
There's a chapter in that book about Goldwater.
That's right.
What happened there? In 1960, and it was all came out of the same group of people, there were some young Republicans, young conservatives, who were not smitten with Mr. Nixon. Did not think that he was so solid on the issues, but he was going to be the nominee. And so they started a kind of Goldwater thing. Goldwater had been reelected to the Senate very comfortably in 1958. And a bunch of different people did different things. Dean Clarence Mannion published a book that was actually written by L. Brent Bozell called The Conscience of a Conservative by Barry Goldwater. This book came out in 1959 or early 60, and it became very popular with a lot of people.
One of the reasons Goldwater is so surprising in 64 is that the people didn't see the 60 movement.
That's right.
That you're talking about.
That's right. We then went up to the convention, so July of 60 in Chicago. And up there, Nixon, ancient history, but he infuriated the conservatives by flying to New York and making a deal with Nelson Rockefeller on the platform. And this is forgotten history now for most people, but it was big deal then. And it was called Goldwater called it a Munich. Just giving Rockefeller whatever he wanted because Nixon feared Rockefeller. And the conservatives, the convention was very conservative, was really restless. And so one of the delegations, I think it was Louisiana or maybe Nevada, or one of the more conservative, decided to submit Goldwater's name and nomination for president. And they did. And I write about it in this book. And the place just exploded. And that was Goldwater then gets up, and it's a very famous, if you ever see a video biography of Goldwater, they may have this in there. He got up, this tumult was going on, and, you know, accepted the plaudits and obviously withdrew. He wasn't going to run. But he made this very powerful speech in which he said, come on, conservatives, let's take this party back. And that's where it started. So it all came out of that. And then right after that, one other thing that happened was that a group of us met right in the Pitt Congress Hotel, which was right down from where the headquarters was for the convention. And I write about this. And YAF, Young Americans for Freedom, was founded, or the idea for it was started right then and there. And Goldwater came by, met with the kids and so forth. And that's where YAF came from.
The 64 election really is another step, isn't it, in terms of increasing the conservative influence. It looks like a defeat, but it really isn't.
I use a line I used this morning that we were buried under rubble. I mean, we were flattened. One would have to go through it to even, you know, I had to stay up all night, watch those returns come in because I had to write an editorial about it. Well, that was miserable. But we just got up and pushed the stones away, and we got to get back at it. And that's what happened. And of course, that was the condition precedent for Reagan. And then later, and I'd referred to this when we talked before, in 1976, he had then been governor of California for two terms and had stepped down. And there were a lot of us. I wrote a book called The Future of Conservatism, it came out in 1968. Which really made Reagan the sort of centerpiece of the whole analysis, that this fellow represented the future of the Republican Party, and he was already governor at that time. And a lot of us thought he should be president. And so in 1976, you know, that whole series of events that made it a very odd political year because Nixon had resigned in 74, and Agnew had resigned before that, so both of your elected president and vice president had been removed from office, and then Gerald Ford, who had been named vice president, became
unelected
president.
Unelected vice president became an unelected president.
And so nothing wrong with Gerald Ford, but we thought Ronald Reagan was more the kind of person we needed. And so we then did run an independent campaign through the American Conservative Union for Reagan in 76. And so I was very much involved in that, not in any way connected to the campaign, because it couldn't be. It had to be independent. But I followed that campaign very closely doing that. And then after that, it became very clear that Reagan would run again in 80, and did, and got the nomination and got elected president.
So what do you think of the Reagan years? That in so many ways, they were the culmination of what the conservative movement had worked for.
They were.
Or I shouldn't maybe say culmination, but at least an outgrowth and,
yes.
and a statement of success by them. And yet there were disappointments, too.
There were, and that's life is like that. I would say, first of all, it is definitely a culmination of the political cycle that began with Goldwater.
That's a better way to put
it. Right. In terms of what Reagan achieved, the number one achievement was winning the Cold War. And that's a pretty large achievement. And it absolutely comes back to him, and it comes back to his strength of conviction. It comes back to his understanding of communism and the weaknesses of it, which he always had. He knew a lot about communism. He had fought the communists in Hollywood, in the Screen Actors Guild. He knew a lot about them, and he knew a lot more than anyone ever gave him credit for in terms of his awareness of what they were about and what they respected and what they didn't respect. And he understood they respected strength, and he had that strength. And that's what finally, I think, won the Cold War.
Stan, one of your books was The Politics of Surrender. Date on is 1966.
Correct.
This is a theme you've developed over a lot of your writing, your newspaper columns, and now you're returning to, again, in current work in progress, the inability to some extent of the American left to think seriously about communism,
yes,
both foreign and domestic.
Well, I think it has been a problem for a long time, and certainly was a problem back then. It dated back to the 30s, really, in which period there was this romantic view of the Soviet Union as some kind of indicator of the future that should be followed not only there but perhaps here, of this top-down collectivist system that was going to solve the ills of mankind, and a lot of philosophical assumptions that were shared by many who were not communists or Marxists, the sort of materialist, secularist, collectivist aspects of what was going on over there were also visible here in a non-communist way. So there was this sort of affinity at that level, and it became very explicit during World War II when the Soviets were our allies and when they were proclaimed as, you know, wonderful heroes, and movies were made like Mission to Moscow that portrayed Russia as some kind of utopia. And there was just an astigmatism there about the real nature of this evil system that made it difficult for well-meaning people in this country really to believe that the communists were as bad as they were and that they would do things that they did do.
Do things that they said they were going to do.
And had done
and
historically.
Had done, right.
And so that's what The Politics of Surrender was about in a 60s context, of this effort constantly to propitiate these people and sort of, it's just a misunderstanding. And if we could just get them to see that we're nice and we'll give them things, we'll make agreements with them, then they'll stop being so hostile to us. And that, it seems to me, was why we were in retreat, because we kept doing that. The linkage to what I'm doing now is that I'm looking at the other side of it, the internal security side of it. in which this same astigmatism led people to think, well, communists really wouldn't try to infiltrate our institutions. They wouldn't, if they did get into the institutions, betray us to a foreign power. They wouldn't do such evil things, and therefore we don't need to worry about that. What we now have, which we are getting more of, is a lot of documentation, such as the Venona transcripts, which are the messages between Moscow Center, KGB, and Soviet agents in the United States, in which they are communicating back and forth about all their activities and all their agents working here in our government and in our country.
They cover what, the 30s and 40s? Or do they go into farther?
The Venona transcripts date from the middle 40s. And they are, it's about 3 or 4 years worth of these cables that really began in the middle of World War II and then ran until a little bit after. But they're not the only documents. There are hundreds of thousands of pages now of FBI files available in the FBI archives, which I've been going through at great length. And it's the same kind of thing. And the FBI was monitoring all of this activity in the 40s. They were doing a lot of wiretapping. They were doing a lot of surveillance. They were opening packages. They were following people around. And they had reams of information, a lot of which overlaps with the Venona stuff. And it really started happening, this infiltration, in World War II, when this romantic image of Moscow translated into this very permissive policy toward communists in this country. And communism was just as American as apple pie or something like that, Earl Browder's view of it. And that's when they had their opportunity to get in, and they did get in. And so that's what these records show, and that's what I'm tracking.
One of the things the left keeps saying, I just saw an article about it the other day in dealing with the Rosenbergs, so that, all right, we concede the communists were at work. They didn't make that concession in the past, but all right, now that this stuff is coming out of Moscow, we can't really deny that. Yeah. But it really didn't make any difference. They didn't betray much. They weren't in positions to betray much, and the American society was too strong and too healthy and too uncommunist to be very badly affected by it.
Well, the danger was never, at least on my reading of the record, that they were going to overthrow America from within. They weren't going to take over the government. What they were doing, they did two main things. They stole things. They stole the atomic secrets. They stole plans. They stole anything they could lay their hands on, documents, and that's where the Rosenbergs came in, and that end of it, and all the atomic espionage. It was very serious stuff. But the other thing they did, which is less publicized, is that they influenced policy. And what I've been looking at particularly is policy toward, say, Yugoslavia, Poland, China, in the immediate post-war period, where these people and others who were perhaps innocents cooperating with them were doing things, and taking like Yugoslavia, where there was a huge propaganda line that the anti-communist leader in Yugoslavia, a man named Draha Mihailovic, was a collaborator with the Nazis, and that he could not be trusted, and that the real hero in Yugoslavia was Tito, who was then a pawn of the Soviets. As a result of all of that propaganda and fake intelligence reports sent back by a man like James Klugman, who was a member of the Cambridge communist ring, who was in Cairo for the British shaping these intelligence reports, Churchill and Roosevelt cut off Mihailovic, believing these fake reports, gave all their aid to Tito, who then conquered Yugoslavia, killed Mihailovic, and turned that into a communist state, which finally, of course, broke with the Soviets. The same thing happened in China, that these agents were sending back bogus intelligence reports from China about Chiang Kai-shek was ineffective fighting the Japanese, and only the Chinese communists were doing the fighting against the Japanese, and that therefore we should cut off Chiang Kai-shek and give our aid to the communists at Yan'an. One of these Soviet agents was a man named Solomon Adler, who shows up in Venona, who was living in a house in Chungking with John Stewart Service, a diplomat there, and a Chinese national named Chi Chao-Ting, who was also a Soviet agent. And they were sending back these bogus reports about the greatness of the communists, the evils of Chiang Kai-shek. That then affected our policy toward China. We cut off Chiang Kai-shek, and the rest, unfortunately, is history.
So it wasn't just nice liberals who were duped. It was actual conscious conspiracy by people who knew exactly what they were
Correct.
Doing in some parts.
Both Solomon Adler and Chi Chao-Ting, who are in the research I'm doing, wound up living in communist China, working for the Chinese communist government. These were not innocent dupes. They were Soviet agents, and so identified in many, many records.
Stan, your most recent book is Theme is Freedom, with a wonderful subtitle, Religion, Politics, and the American Tradition. And to me, at least, this is kind of the summation of all those endless nights of lecturing to student bodies and late-night conversations with all these interesting people you knew. And it's an interesting book. And you say at the beginning of it that you're going to tell a story that, in one sense, is familiar, but that seems to have all the details wrong. And you begin by saying here early on in the book, there is a strong conservative tradition in the United States, rooted in the still longer tradition of our English forebears, and more broadly speaking, in two millennia of Western culture. The key political insight of this tradition is precisely the idea of imposing limits on governmental power in the interests of protecting freedom, a doctrine that became the core and essence of American theory at the epoch of our founding. And I gather you think at the heart of the American experience.
Absolutely.
From the beginning.
Absolutely so. And I do believe that, and I think the record supports it. And this really is a sort of the flip side of what we were talking about a little earlier about the secular, materialistic premises of modern thought and the consequences that follow from that, which have been very bad, the dehumanization of the human personality and the despotisms of the 20th century and so on. All of those things were based on these relativist, nihilist, materialist, secularist premises. Denial of God, and as a result of the denial of God, the denial that human beings are the children of God and deserve to be respected as such.
And you call it a new paganism, saying
very much
so. The ancients and Greeks and Rome had very many of the same ideas, that humans were instruments of the gods or the emperor.
Well, they in particular,
polis.
They in particular did not believe in the worth of the individual human being as we do. And that, for example, even in Aristotle, and I quote Aristotle in the book, who is arguably the most agreeable of the ancients from our standpoint, and there's a lot in Aristotle that I think is great. But he says very explicitly that slavery is justified, that some people are born to be slaves, that other people are born to rule over them, that there are people that are superior and people that are inferior, and the superior should rule the inferior, and so on and on and on. Infanticide was common in those societies, not just abortion, but infanticide, if they thought a child was not what they wanted, they just kill it or leave it out on the side of the road to die, and many other manifestations of that point of view. With Judaism and Christianity, you get a totally different idea that we are the children of God and that we are possessed of some divine connection, and that our existence is decreed by God, and there is a dignity and a worth, the human soul, and all of that, which is very central to the Western religious view. And it is from that view that then you get certain ideas about what you can't do to people. You get certain ideas about the limits on the power of the state, that the state in pagan society was all-powerful. It could do anything. In Western society, The key insight, it's medieval, is from Bracton, the medieval jurist in England, who said the king is under God and under the law. And the pagan view is the king is the law speaking. Whatever the king says is the law. In the Western religious view, the king is always under God and under the law. And that is the genesis of constitutionalism, limited government. And these two ideas of the dignity and worth of the human person and limits on the reach of power and what that power can do to the human person are the building blocks of the free society. And what I try to do in my book is to trace how that grew in the medieval period and then in England under the common law and then the settlements of New England and Virginia here in America and the founding of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So that's kind of the way that book came together.
So American liberty really is dependent upon a Christian understanding of liberty and of humanity.
Well, historically, there's no question that that's where it came from. Now, and I would include the Judaism part in. As you know better than I, because you're a much better scholar of these matters than I am, that the Puritan clergy of New England were great students of the Old Testament as well as the New. They knew they had the Mosaic Law in their minds and on their books, too, in many cases.
Well, and another thing you talk about at great length, the idea of covenant.
Covenantal theology, absolutely. And what that means for viewers who are not familiar with it is the idea that it's very congruent with what this limited government model, that there's a lot of philosophical aspect, but what it meant in terms of church organization was that the authority came from the congregation, hence the congregational churches. No bishops, no top-down king or bishops imposing clergy. The congregation chose the minister. Well, you can see how that translates politically, that it's bottom-up, not top-down. All of that was in the mix in New England. And so historically, that's where it all came from. Stated as a proposition that it must be dependent would be denied. I don't think anyone can deny the history if they study it, but the liberal experiment is to say, well, we don't need that. That they might even admit the history, but say now we can have it on a purely secular foundation, denying religion, denying as we see in a lot of court decisions, that you can't have the Ten Commandments in a schoolhouse. You know, ridiculous. But it's an effort, the liberal effort is to cut away from all that theological, religious underpinning and just have the byproducts, secular byproducts, by themselves. And my contention is in the book, that doesn't work. It's like cutting the roots of a tree or cutting a flower from the stem. Put it in a vase, and maybe for a few days it looks okay, but in a week it's going to be dead because you've severed it from the nourishment that gave it life.
That does make it a much more controversial thesis in some ways than at first blush, because as you say, we might be able to agree in the history. We might say we've moved beyond that, that we know enough now about the world we live in from a scientific, rationalist point of view that we can see the usefulness of that, but it's no longer necessary.
Well, I think the subject can be divided in that way. However, I would go back a little bit and say that characteristically, our friends on the other side, the American Civil Liberties Union, people of that ilk with whom I'm very familiar, they deny the history.
And as you say here, it's not found in most of the textbooks.
It certainly isn't. And for example, there is a totally bogus rendering of the history of the First Amendment that is embedded in many of the Supreme Court decisions, that Madison and Jefferson were secularists who were trying to banish all religion from the public square and so forth and so on, which is just historically untrue. But that's the basis for these decisions, saying you can't have prayer in the public schools, you can't have prayer in a tax-supported facility. There's no support for that historically, none, zero. And yet that is widely believed and propounded by the ACLU and the people who follow them.
Another good example of that is your discussion of the Declaration of Independence, where it's so often portrayed as a product of the rationalist Enlightenment, and you see it as a very different sort of document.
endowed by their creator? Yes, I think that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator. This is the vernacular of Western Christendom. But also, I pause on that to think it is self-evident that all men are created equal, et cetera. And I ask students or audiences, do you believe that? Is that we're all created equal? One part of the statement, the other, that it's self-evident. And I would say, yes, I believe it, and I think it's self-evident. But then I go back to Aristotle. It wasn't self-evident to Aristotle.
Or for most of the world, really,
right,
throughout history.
Right. But just to take Aristotle,
yeah,
and
right,
I say Aristotle, a lot smarter than I am, by, you know, several hundred IQ points. So how come I know something that Aristotle didn't know? And the answer is I have something he didn't have. I have the Bible. He didn't have it. And if you want to know where it comes from, read. It's in Galatians, it's in Genesis, it's in all over the Bible, that we're all the children of God. There's neither bond nor free, Greek nor Gentile, male nor female. We're all one in Christ. That's what the Bible says. And so Aristotle did not have the benefit of reading this, and he only had was his pure intellect, and he couldn't figure it out. But I know it because I've got the Bible, and Jefferson knew it because he had the Bible.
Well, another thing you say is the Declaration really is in the great line of great charters. About personal liberties against the state.
Absolutely correct. It is also part of a historical sequence. And you mentioned that you had been at a seminar in which people were reading Richard II. And it is part of an historical sequence in which the deposition of Richard II is a crucial event. And if you go back and look, and I have this in my book, that when Richard II was deposed by Parliament in favor of Henry IV, the Parliament very explicitly said that he had violated the terms of his oath, that he had said the laws were in his mouth, that he had done other things violating the feudal law, and that the throne was thereby vacant. That was the wording of that resolution. And then Henry IV, Bolingbroke, was able to be chosen king by the Parliament. That's 1399. You come forward to 1688 and other things along the way, and you look at the deposition of James II. They went back to that and said, okay, that's the way they deposed Richard II, and they adopted a formula saying that James has violated, he's done this and that, and that the throne is thereby vacant. And so James is then out, and they put in William and Mary. Come forward to 1776, read Chief Justice Drayton talking about the British, that George III has done all these things, he's violated his oath, that he's no longer king, the throne is thereby vacant. And that's the same thing it says in the Declaration. So, and Jefferson, they knew all this. They knew this history. And this was all, the Declaration of Independence was a culmination of this British parliamentary tradition dating back really to Magna Carta, in which the king is under God and under the law. He can't do whatever he wants to.
And in effect, in a covenantal relationship with his people.
Exactly right. It's a contract. It is a contract. He's violated, and that's said. It's said very clearly in all of these, and it's said in the Declaration of Independence. He's violated the contract. He's no longer king. We no longer owe him obedience. The throne is vacant, and et cetera. That's in the Declaration. It's part of that common law mosaic. It wasn't just a purely abstract philosophical statement.
Another thing you say in the book, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to say this just as nicely as you do, but it's a really interesting point, and that is that the Judeo-Christian world undoes the world of magic.
Yes.
And
yes.
puts people into a purposeful history,
correct,
ordered by law, accessible by human reason.
Correct.
Now, that's really important, but it's also, many would say, the basis of kind of secular scientific thought.
It is. It is the basis of modern science. And I'll try to state it in a way that I hope can make it clear as I see it. It begins with the theological doctrine of monotheism. It begins with getting away from the pagan view. The pagan view of the world was polytheistic. There were gods in the wind, gods of the war, gods of the harvest, gods of the river, gods of the forest, gods of the hearth. The world was full of gods, various gods, who caused things to happen and success in battle, good harvest, whatever. God's in nature. The nature was itself full of deities of all types and was itself a deity. With Judaism and Christianity, all that is gone, and there is one God. He created everything else. There are no other gods. And that's pretty clear from the beginning in the Old Testament. And therefore, all of these demons and deities and whatever are banished. They're gone. And what you have is an orderly world created by a creator God who gave it form, who gave it meaning, who gave it life. And all of it is in obedience to his will and his ordination. And it's all in Augustine is full of that, and the orderly nature of the universe. That mindset of the there are no demons, there are no gods in nature, is essential to science.
You also make, I think, a very significant connection with the death of magic to the limitations upon secular political power again, because
yes.
Now there are no kings and priests who have special
correct.
Knowledge.
That's correct. Esoteric knowledge, that it is absolutely key, and that's a very good point, because the way in the pagan view, there were certain people who were the links between humanity and these gods in nature. And so the Roman consul, for example, or various kings and other societies were presumed to have some aspect of divinity themselves, and they were the go-betweens between all these gods in nature and the society. And it was up to them to appease these gods and with their special knowledge. Well, in our...
It's often these forces were hostile to humans, which is another difference between the
that's correct.
Judeo-Christian God. But anyway,
That is a good point. In the biblical view, and Auguste Comte, for example, hated Christianity for this, every person has a direct link to God. Every human being has a direct connection to the infinite in the Judeo-Christian conception. There are no supermen. We're all children of God. We're all part of his creation, but we're all also sinners. And it doesn't matter if somebody's a king or a beggar. They're both children of God and both sinners. So there's no different species. And there's one group of people that, well, they're really special. They can rule over all these other people. There's none of that in the biblical view. And one of my favorite passages in the Bible is Samuel 1:8, where the children of Israel are crying out for a king. You know, and Samuel goes and talks to the Lord, and he comes back and says, the king, he says, you know what a king is going to do? He's going to take your crops and your sons and your daughters, and he said, and he'll take a tenth. And I thought Samuel kind of underestimated the problem
right.
here. But it was very hostile to the king. There was no worshiping of a king. This was not some god.
Finally, what you do in this book is you link all this to the American government under the Constitution, which
yes.
you see as sort of the last great medieval
I do.
Constitution.
I think what happened, and impossible to summarize it very briefly, there was a series. First of all, there's a total misconception of the Middle Ages. It was a very free, decentralized society and a market society in many ways. That was overturned at the Renaissance on the European continent by the rise of these absolute monarchies, the Louis XIV type thing. Attempt was made to revive it in England. The Stuarts and so on, and there are all these battles in Parliament about the king can do whatever he wants to, just like the monarchs of Europe. The Puritans resisted this, and when it looked like the ball game was lost, they left Parliament in 1628 and came here, went to New England. And they brought these limited government notions with them, and they planted those same ideas on American soil. And then when England itself then drifted off into a more parliamentary sovereignty thing, which was as bad in its way as absolute monarchy, we rejected that too. And our forefathers of the time of the Revolution, and it's all in the histories that you know better than I, over and over again said, no, Parliament is not sovereign either. That's not correct. There's no human power is without limitation.
Stan, since 1977, one of the really interesting projects you've been engaged in is the National Journalism Center. Can you tell us a few things about what its accomplishments have been?
Well, it stemmed very much from my experience here in Indianapolis again, because I came to believe, and I think a lot of other people have too, that the way that journalism was being done, the way the media were being run, was unsatisfactory, to put it as charitably as possible. And most people think, when they hear that, that I'm talking about bias, that there's liberal bias in the media, and there is. But that isn't really the main problem, or at least only one of them. What I became concerned about was journalists covering issues they did not understand. Journalists covering issues that they didn't even try to understand. And this has become progressively worse as the issues have become more complex. When I started out in the business, nobody was writing about global warming or healthcare policy or any environmental issues or technical scientific questions. And it was a good thing, because journalists are not trained in any of those things. Most journalists have no science background. They have no econ background. They don't know anything about these matters. And they're journalists because they didn't want to learn about those. I said, I didn't, you know, take science courses. I didn't want to take science courses. I was an English lit major, and I'm sure most other journalists have similar background. We don't have the training to handle these things, and so we have to make a special effort. As I talked about that book I did 25 years ago, I dug in and tried to learn about these things. Most journalists don't do that, and so they become...
Except the press releases of groups they think...
Or sound bites from whoever can get in front of a microphone. So it's just a bunch of confusion and nonsense. And the same errors are made over and over again. Every time, I talked about this earlier, every time there's a blip in gas prices, the price of gasoline goes up, you know, to $1.40 a gallon or whatever it might be. Then, oh, we've got to have an investigation of this. And Capitol Hill mobilizes, and various interest groups make statements, and the media cover it just like, you know, like it never happened before. And they're clueless as to prices and why prices do what they do and why they go up or down and why price controls are a disaster. They know nothing of that. And it's just done over and over again. And it seems to me that that is even a more serious problem than the bias problem, or it compounds it. And but then there's the superficiality, the quick turnaround and just ephemera that are things that pass for news. And it's just a big ball of confusion and misinformation. So, having said all that, I thought we need to have something a little bit different in which journalists are not trained in this way, and we try to train them to be good, solid, substantive reporters as opposed to just transmission belts or quotes by politicians. And that's what that's the genesis of the National Journalism Center. We try to train our students that way. So it's not just running and getting a quote. And it's just little tricks of the trade. I tell my students, if you go to a hearing, first of all, go to the hearing. Don't sit at the internet and just pull down what somebody else wrote. You go to the hearing, and when the hearing is over, say Senator Kennedy has been conducting a hearing on health care, which he likes to do, and or anybody, and after the hearing is over, a whole bunch of people with microphones will go stick these microphones in Kennedy's face and ask him a question and get a quote. I say to my students, don't you do that. Watch the hearing. You'll see that when Kennedy is conducting the hearing, there's some guy who's standing in back of him, is leaning over, watching him on C-SPAN. He's whispering to Kennedy. He's handing him documents. Kennedy's asking him questions. He's going back and forth. I say, when the rest of the reporters are following Kennedy and yelling, Senator, Senator, you follow that guy. He's the guy that knows what's going on. He's the issue expert. Kennedy's not. And nobody's interviewing him. He'll tell you, he'll give you the information. You go follow him. But if you're not at that hearing, you don't know who he is. It's not on the internet. So that's just a little example. I mean, that's one of many examples of the way we try to teach
them. Let's teach them to be serious reporters, to do their homework, to not be lazy and glib, and also to teach them some of the nuts and bolts of how you go about reporting.
Yes, the nuts and bolts part is fairly easy. I mean, it's not, as we say, not rocket science. But the substantive understanding, I often say, and I don't think that I'm so great at this, but I say I think I can teach a reasonably intelligent person how to write a lead and how to write a story. You know, give me 6 weeks, I think I can teach, you know, why anybody would spend 4 years in college studying this, I don't know. But what I cannot teach is remedial civilization in 6 weeks. So we're looking for students who bring something to the table, who have a strong educational background to begin with, if possible, and who are reasonably, you know, sharp in their thinking. And if I can get such a student who wants to read, I can teach that person to be a journalist, I think. But I can't teach everything of substance in 6 weeks, or others can't either. The one thing we do try to teach them a little bit is free market economics and the pricing system, because it just pervades so many energy, healthcare, environment, rent controls, farm subsidies, minimum wage, on and on. The pricing mechanism is so central to everything that happens in our domestic economy. We try to teach them about prices. And if they know that, they'll be light years ahead of their competition.
Let's talk just a minute more about a theme of freedom. One person who is an old friend of yours, Frank S. Meyer, surely have liked this book, because you are really providing the historical and intellectual background of his work in defense of freedom, I think, which is more a polemic and an assertion of a position. This used to be called fusionism, a word that I'm not sure who invented, maybe Russell Kirk.
I think Brent Bozell. I think it was Brent. Yeah.
I think Meyer, right, who didn't like it.
Yeah, that's right.
So what would you say about Frank Meyer and fusionism? And
well, first of all, I think your observation is very astute. I envision this book almost as a companion book to In Defense of Freedom. I mean, that's the way I thought of it, not in the sense that you take them in, as a box set, but that Frank gives this theoretical, metaphysical, powerful, I think.
I do, too.
And I envision my book, and I could never replicate what Frank did, and I don't need to. He did it. But I thought there needs to be a sort of, you know, let's look at the history here of what actually did happen, because he makes references to that but doesn't really develop it. And so you're right on target in what you say, because that, I think, I hope Frank would have liked it. I would like to believe that he would. And he was a marvelous, marvelous man and a great, powerful intellect. And the fusionism thing, and the reason I don't like the word is because it implies, and of course what is being fused is religion and liberty, or virtue and liberty, or some tradition and freedom, or some variant of that. Like, you're taking these two totally dissimilar things and kind of cramming them together by some synthetic method to put things together that really naturally are separate. I mean, that's what that word conveys to me. And from my,
I think it was what Bozell was suggesting.
Yeah, and by the way, but since we've mentioned Brent's name, he was a dear friend of Frank's and mine. So there was
an old argument that you loved to engage in over the years.
Well, Frank and Brent really engaged in it. I was kind of on the sidelines, but anyway, I just wanted to make that point. But Brent, I think, did invent the word. And but anyway, my view of it is just totally different. So it's not, it seems to me the word itself is freighted with prejudice against what I consider to be the true position, which is that not only do freedom and tradition, can they go together, they have to go together. And that if you don't have, for all the reasons we were sort of touching on previously, if you don't have this underpinning of axioms about the value of the human person and the need to limit power, if you don't have those axioms, then you can't have freedom. And so if you try to build a free society on purely relativist, materialist premises, which is the nature of the liberal enterprise, that's almost exactly what it is in so many words, it's not going to work. It doesn't work. And because you don't have the principles at the core of it that prevent this accumulation of power and treating people like guinea pigs and so forth. So not only do I think that freedom and religion, however phrased, can go together, they must go together.
Stan, it's been good to talk about this again. We've talked about it over the years many times in many ways, and hope this won't be the last opportunity we have to engage in some of these themes together. Thanks for coming to Liberty Fund in Indianapolis and sharing this time with us.
Thank you.